Welcome to the Women's Wellness Psychiatry Podcast. I'm so glad you're here. I'm your host, Anna Glazer, MD, a reproductive and integrative psychiatrist here to help you make sense of the complex world of women's mental health. If your goal is to improve your emotional well-being, find fulfillment, and feel like your best self, you're in the right place.
Welcome, my listener friends. This podcast episode is being released on April 10th, the date of the start of our April session of the online fellowship in reproductive and integrative psychiatry. So it's not too late to sign up. You can use the link in the show notes to do so. This episode of the podcast will cover addiction in perinatal populations, which is a really broad topic. So we're focusing primarily on opiate addiction in this episode, which is an epidemic in this country, as I'm sure many of you have heard about in various reports. And I'm excited to speak with Dr. Sarah Nasir, a family medicine doctor and addictions expert who currently works treating patients struggling with substance use and is launching an addictions medicine clinic here in California, in addition to her ongoing work as a coach. Take a listen to my great conversation, this really important topic with Dr. Nasir.
Thank you so much, Dr. Nasir, for joining me for this episode.
Thank you, Dr. Glazer. I'm really excited to be here.
So we have a lot to chat about today, such a broad topic, which is addiction in perinatal patients. But why don't we start with some background? Maybe you could share with listeners a little bit more about your background, how you became drawn and passionate to this work.
Thank you. Yeah, I would be happy to. So I am an osteopathic family medicine physician, and I'm now subspecializing in addiction medicine. I graduated from West Virginia School of Osteopathic Medicine, but originally I'm actually from California. I went to UC Davis and I got an engineering degree there. But then afterwards, I knew I always wanted to be a doctor. So I went to West Virginia, got trained with some amazing professors and an amazing philosophy. That holistic approach is what brings me to this path of my life today, where I have provided primary care throughout these past 5 to 6 years and also been taking care of addiction medicine patients. I've worked with patients with opioid use disorder, alcohol use disorder, benzodiazepine use disorder, different substances, methamphetamine abuse disorder as well. And currently, I am working as a medical director at the local methadone clinic. So there's that other spectrum of care that I'm providing. The reason I'm in this is because I saw the devastation that opioid was having in the community and specifically individuals. In my residency, where I finished up my residency, apparently we were sitting on a drug belt that was going from Mexico up to Canada. And there was a lot of pill mill activity happening. So if you don't know what that means, there was this time when pain was being treated as a patient satisfaction measure. And so doctors were being encouraged to prescribe medicines that was controlling their pain and thus addressing the patient's dissatisfaction. And what that ended up leading to was this widespread prescription of the opioids without people realizing how addicting they were or being able to recognize the withdrawal symptoms. So what the patients, once they became hooked and whether they wanted to or not. And at that time, we really didn't have as much widely available addiction medicine treatment. And thus the patients ended up switching from opioids to other hard drugs, which ended up being like heroin. So going back to my residency, I was at that phase where there was more restrictions being implemented on how we're prescribing the opioids to our patients. That ended up resulting in a lot of patients suddenly losing access to their chronic prescriptions, and thus they ended up turning to heroin. And so I got to see that, and they were transferring the heroin from Mexico all the way up to Canada, and we were sitting in that area. Now, what I see a lot of is fentanyl, and the way that the landscape has changed is fentanyl is a lot easier to make in the laboratories compared to heroin, which is made from pure opium poppies. So it's harder to get a pure heroin. Fentanyl, now the drug cartels are sending them into different suppliers, and it's easier for them to mix with other impurities such as ecstasy or PCP. And so you see a lot of patients now what they're using ends up being fentanyl, which is harder to, it's 50 times more potent than heroin, right? So it causes overdoses much faster, much easier. You don't know what's in the pill that you're getting because the suppliers are actually pressing their own pill and putting their insignia on it. And so you have this like brand even. And so to increase the street value of what is being sold, you're seeing that more and more impurities are being introduced. And what that ends up doing is it worsens the opioid cravings and dependence. What else? Now, another thing that's out in the market is called xylazine. This is an alpha-2 agonist, which is a blood pressure medicine. It's commonly used only in animals as tranquilizer. So this is used for horses as tranquilizers. But because it's cheaper to get and to increase the value of the pills that are being sold to the customers, they're mixing xylazine into it. And you're seeing more overdoses and life-threatening limb infection and skin necrosis. Necrosis means your skin is dying, basically, and the infection can spread. So you either lose the limb or you lose your life. So it's been very fascinating seeing this evolution throughout my, since I started. Nonetheless, it's a very satisfying position that I'm in, that I'm able to actually help cater to the needs of a very, what is it? What's the word I want to use? A population who feels it's difficult to go and ask for help.
Absolutely. And so just to dive into some of the things that you mentioned, it's also very interesting that this timeline that you're talking about, we're not talking about 50 years. We're talking about a very short amount of time where all of these changes took place. And so what you're seeing quite a bit now, what we're seeing in general is fentanyl, which is more potent and also mixed with so many more impurities. And then this new substance, which is combined with the fentanyl. And so one is a tranquilizer and kind of blood pressure medication. The other is an opiate. And so you're combining those two together. And that sounds like a recipe for disaster.
Yeah. And it's starting to go around. And one of the DEA presentations I was listening to, they were saying that of the tablets or pills that were seized, 7 out of the 10 fentanyl pills were of deadly doses. So it's not that 7 out of the 10 pills had fentanyl. 7 out of the 10 pills actually had lethal doses. If you're not used to that high level and you think you're just doing an oxycodone from your grandma's cabinet or something, no, it's the stuff that knocks you out and causes you to stop breathing, right? And it's the lack of air, lack of oxygen that leads to death. So one of the movements that is now being encouraged is never use alone. It's a little counterintuitive in the general population, but for the population that I treat, the last thing you want to do is overdose and have nobody around you to resuscitate you.
Absolutely. And I know that certainly in our area and maybe across the country, they're certainly making overdose treatment more available. Like Narcan is much more readily available than it had been. And if I'm not mistaken, it's now available to folks who aren't necessarily clinicians as well.
Correct. So if you're a provider, you're watching this, the recommendations at this time are if you have a chronic pain patient, you know, who's on chronic opioids, prescribe them a Narcan prescription for themselves. And if somebody comes to you and says, hey, I would like to have Narcan for somebody, for my family member, you can prescribe it to them as well. There's actually a separate ICD-10 code for it too, that you're prescribing it to somebody who's around opioid use disorder. Feel free to teach it to them. Narcan is pretty easy to use. It has a nozzle. It's like those allergy medicine Flonase you put in your nose, but it has two prongs. So you put it in and you push it. And normally we recommend having two prescribed, because what happens is when you have a large amount of opioid in the system, once the Narcan wears off, Narcan's generic name is Naloxone. Once the naloxone wears off, the remaining heroin or fentanyl in high amount can actually go and bind to the receptor again. So you can go into overdose right after you get resuscitated again. So it's recommended to prescribe two of these. So if you see somebody going into overdose again, push it again. But the first time you see it, call 911. So help.
Yes. Absolutely. Absolutely. Important step. Could you talk with us a little bit about, since we focus quite a bit on women's mental health and women's health here, on the prevalence rates or, you know, what the landscape looks like in those who identify as women and particularly in perinatal patients?
I don't have numbers for you at this moment, unfortunately, because one of the things that I've noticed in my journey so far is that women tend to seek less help, unfortunately.
In addictions.
In addiction, yes. Normally, it tends to be men, a lot of them because they're losing jobs or they're getting into legal trouble. So court mandated, that tends to be more men versus women. We are more of adapters. We know how to hide more. So for some reason, like, women tend to fall through the cracks a little bit more, in my opinion, especially in the perinatal time. I don't get a lot of women coming saying, hey, I'm pregnant and I want help. But those that do, they're very motivated. So I think what I would encourage is to start the conversation more, that if you are somebody who is using, go seek help. Because once you have the street stuff, you don't know what's in it. You don't know what you're being exposed to and what your child is being exposed to. So coming and seeking the help, whether you're taking the Suboxone or the methadone, they're both much better than the street contaminants that's being put into your body. And I also think there isn't enough dialogue happening in the medical professional field where obstetricians or family medicine physicians are encouraging the women to go seek help. A lot of the women are worried about having CPS called on them, so they don't often go and seek help until the baby is due to begin with. And the lifestyle they lead, oftentimes they're exchanging sex for money or sex for housing, or they're with somebody who it just becomes their norm. They don't feel comfortable going out and asking for help. So I think it's a little bit of a different dynamics that is hopefully going to be addressed and explored a little bit more. But that's why I wanted to take this opportunity to come and talk and raise awareness that encourage your women. Whether you are somebody who is using or you have a loved one who is a woman who's using, to encourage them to get that help. Another stigma that gets in the way that's really difficult is a lot of times men or women, they and the family that's supporting them, they think that seeking treatment is the same as switching one drug for another drug. So they're thinking it's the same. So what's the point of going and subjecting yourself to the shame and the stigma and then having CPS alerted and being called on you? So one of the things I say to my patients in that situation to help at least take down that barrier to care, that mindset, that you are not switching drug for drug. Yes, it's chemical for chemical, but you are switching a disease for a treatment. Look at it that way. Because after a while, when you keep using opioids, methamphetamines, alcohol, your body changes. The neurochemistry changes where if you, to protect you and keep you alive, your body starts to adapt by making sure that you don't die on these legal doses of fentanyl, right? So it's making less endorphins, which are natural chemicals that happen in your body. It's pulling away the opioid receptors. So you are left in this diseased state where your body's unable to compensate and close that chemical gap by itself. So you need something to stabilize you. And that's what we do with the treatment, is that we give our patients just the amount that's necessary to bring them back up to baseline as somebody who does not use opioids. And you see that impact in pain management as well. And I know we're talking about perinatology, but I'm going to talk a little postnatal concept here is about pain management in postpartum women. I know that we are really scared of getting our patients addicted now that we're on the other side of the pendulum. But when a woman has pushed another human being out of her body after nurturing it, she is going to be in pain. And so if they have some sort of medication-assisted opioid treatment in place, it brings them back to baseline so you can continue prescribing them as they need. But if there's somebody who doesn't have any treatment on board, they're not being prescribed that methadone, or methadone is normally what's prescribed in the hospital rather than buprenorphine. To close that gap, you need to close that gap, and then you can give the regular pain medicine. Otherwise, you'll see that they need more because they're at the bottom of a hole versus somebody who's at the regular level. So yeah, so because of that, I don't see as many pregnant patients as I think I should.
Yeah, it sounds like it's both a clinician inquiry kind of issue, a clinician education issue, the need to do more thorough screening and assessments, connecting with patients. It sounds like there's a number of stereotypes and stigmas that need to be debunked. I'm sure it also, there's state by state differences. You and I both happen to be in the state of California, which has perhaps much more kind and appropriate statutes for women who are seeking help for their substance issues in the context of their children compared to some other states in this country, unfortunately. But I think dispelling some of those myths and some of that stigma is important. And to your point, the point that you made when we first started talking is, you don't know what's in those pills, right? There's so many contaminants, so many different kinds of doses. Who knows if there's even fentanyl in there? Versus the treatment, which is very much standardized and regulated and dosed. And so you're really transitioning to something that is much better known. And treatment is not just a prescription of methadone, right? The treatment also includes all of the supportive infrastructure around that, counseling, treatment of any underlying traumas or mental health conditions. And so there's a lot there that you're not, to debunk that, you're treating a drug for a drug. You're treating a drug for a treatment.
Exactly. Exactly. I think that's very well put. And the other thing is other fear that women who are pregnant and they are on the treatment have, is it going to be impacting my baby? Because mothers, at the end of the day, we really care about who we're delivering and giving the new generation a good foot off to stand on. In that situation, what I tell my patients is, if you don't do this, if you don't get the treatment that you need, your body would drive you to use something else. And if you are somebody who's strong enough to bear those withdrawal symptoms, it would make your pregnancy process, delivery process feel very extra difficult. So does medicine impact? We don't know everything in medicine. With every turn of every few decades, we have new findings that aspirin is not good for kids. Ibuprofen, you try not to take it during pregnancy. So new findings come up every time. So I can't tell right now if it's going to be a significant impact on the baby in the future. But the fact that they are being exposed to heroin and fentanyl in utero is not good for them either. So go with the one that we have more control over. And the best thing you can do for yourself is support your body in the way it needs. So you have a delivery without having to go into premature delivery. Because if you're having withdrawals, you have the risk of going into labor much earlier than regular non-opioid dependent pregnancies. It's at the end of the day, it's the evaluation of harm to benefit reduction. And I try to be open and honest with my patients about that. It's that go through the process that's the safer route given the options that you have. So you can come out of it yourself in a better situation to take care of your baby, because pregnancy is difficult as is. Giving birth is difficult as is. Raising a baby is difficult as is. And when you have an illness like this, it makes it harder. So we're here to help on that note. There's plenty of help available, but you have to give yourself permission for that. And especially you have to believe that you are worth it compared to what others say, that somehow you're less if you need help to have a healthy pregnancy and a healthy outcome.
And I think that's a general stigma with addiction overall, is often the sense of addiction as a moral failing as opposed to addiction as a medical ailment, the way that diabetes might be, for example. And so I think working to change that stigma. I think the other interesting thing is, correct me if I'm wrong, but I believe I've read that most individuals who have whatever their kind of primary substance might be often are also using other substances as well. And so treatment is often targeting maybe opiates and maybe alcohol or any number of other kinds of addictions. We can have a food addiction or a gambling addiction, or those dopamine neurons and receptors are very potent.
Yes. So we do love feeling happy.
And so what might treatment look like for someone who maybe they're at a place where they're ready to get some more information?
Yeah. So you definitely have inpatient options, outpatient options, depending on how severe is your withdrawal symptom going to be, the detox process. If you're somebody who has been on alcohol for a long period of time, and that can cause a lot of birth defects and malformations and cognitive delay in the baby if you're drinking heavily. So for that, you definitely do not want to go through a detox process by yourself outside, because with alcohol, you have the risk of withdrawal seizures, which is known as delirium tremens, and that can actually be very life-threatening if it's not done properly. So what's bad for the mom is going to be bad for the baby. So if that's something that is in the picture, also benzodiazepines are also notorious for having delirious tremens-like seizures because they work on similar receptors in the brain. And so if you have a long-term prescription of benzodiazepine, which are medicines like Xanax, Ativan, clonazepam, or Klonopin, if you try to quit it cold turkey, that's not a good idea because it can lead to seizures. For those co-occurring substances, your physician should be aware to help guide you through the proper observation. If you're doing outpatient therapy for opioid use disorder, and even if you seek help on time and we have time to guide you through it, a lot of this can be done outpatient as well. Then regular check-ins with your addiction medicine doctor, as well as making sure that your OB is also informed and aware. This is a team effort, right? As Dr. Glazer was saying, that there's counseling involved. There is also that holistic other aspect of it involved too. You should keep going to your regular prenatal care visits. You should take your prenatal vitamins as well. Coming back to the substances, cocaine and methamphetamine is a little harder drug just because of the way these stimulants work. Those are, I'm more worried about, because cocaine can actually cause placental abruption. You know, if you're using very heavily, your placenta, the womb, can rupture, right? So when you're coming for help, like, the more we know, the more honest you are able to be with us. And the treatment should be a non-judgmental space. This should be a place where you come for help, and that's what you get, not judgment. The honesty helps us help the patients the best way we can, because our patients have been living in their bodies the longest. They know their own health the most. So I do give that value of trust and judgment, that they know what they're talking about. But if my patients don't tell me about what they're doing, my ability to help them would be limited. So it's a patient-centric care, and it involves a lot of different team members, like myself, OB, psychiatrist, because a lot of times, as you mentioned, polysubstance abuse also has a lot of comorbid, untreated mental health conditions and things like ADD. Women tend to know, like, the way we live, it masks our ability to be showing that we have attention deficit. If you have something like schizophrenia, it is a very common co-occurring mental condition that really can impact the health of overall health of the woman, as well as the pregnancy and the baby. So you want the whole team involved, and as many care members that are involved, that is part of the support system. you might have a case manager involved to help you in the out in the community. A lot of women tend to be homeless, unfortunately, they don't necessarily have to live on the street. They can be couch surfing and being in unsafe environments with others around who are using because they don't have a safe place to go. So a case manager could be somebody who helps you get that safe living situation. And even after the baby is delivered, finding housing so you can take care of the baby properly. So yeah, I think those are the key figures that are coming to mind when I'm thinking about this.
And I think you're absolutely right in terms of also just the importance of some of these other members of the team, like the case manager or social worker, who will help you find a therapeutic environment, because it doesn't do any good to go through a supported detox process only to then find yourself back in the environment that's so triggering in the first place and unsafe in the first place. So those social and environmental components of addiction are just as important as the neurochemistry.
Yeah. And another thing I've heard my patients talk about is, doc, I don't want my other doctor to find out. I don't want my insurance to find out, because cost also is a big impact. And then if they get discovered, at work, they're afraid of losing their livelihood. So there is a lot of factors that go into the well-being and the recovery process. And that's what I tell my patients, is that you have so many other things to sort out, coming up with an environment that helps you stay sober. The medication-assisted treatments helps take care of one of the aspects of the struggle, which is your body trying to balance itself. And it's just like you said, just like diabetes, you wouldn't blame a person for having to use insulin because their body is not making enough of what they need.
Exactly. Yeah. And I think just thinking about it that way can help alleviate a lot of the shame that comes with this particular illness.
Definitely.
Yeah. What else would you like listeners to know about both those who might be struggling with the illness of addiction, have a loved one with that, particularly in perinatal or postpartum, as well as clinicians who might be seeing these patients?
Yeah, I think for clinicians, first and foremost, understand that the person sitting in front of you is a human, and what you might be seeing is a manifestation of the disease. If they're looking angry, if they're looking disconnected, if they look like this person is just not getting what I'm talking about, understand that this is a human being at the end of the day. So trying to approach everybody is to the best of your ability. With empathy and creating that safe space for them will help the patient open up. They might not open up on the first visit because sometimes they themselves are just feeling so ashamed, so guilty. They don't know where to ask for help, or maybe they're under the influence, so their cognitive abilities are quite impaired, right? But you might catch them at a time when they're looking for help and they think, oh, Dr. Nasir or Dr. Glazer, I remember that they were warm and welcoming and they were willing to listen without making me feel judged. And in the OB room, when you're encountering a patient, not everybody might be using. It might be 1 out of 10 patients who's using, but scared to tell you. I think it would be helpful to have that universal screening question that do you use, and then just having like flyers or something. So even having to talk to them directly, because they might tell you no, but they might be reading the flyers where it says, if you're using, help is available, or having flyers that they might be able to pick up discreetly to learn how to ask for help. I think those would be some very helpful ways to reach an audience that often doesn't get the help it needs because they feel shy about seeking that help. In regards to the patients, please do understand that your life is worth it. Your loved ones are worth you being here. And no matter what difficulty you're going through, if you put your mind to it, you can overcome it. And sometimes that means pairing up the mindset with actions. that might mean getting help in stabilizing your neurochemistry, your biochemistry with some chemicals, because my sixth grade teacher used to say we're all bought bags of chemicals because there's chemical reaction happening everywhere. And right now we are really nervous about putting chemicals into our body, but every time you eat or drink, you're putting chemicals into your body, right? So it's about, is it the right thing for you? So feel free to seek help if you feel you're not being heard. It's absolutely okay to try and talk to somebody else to get second and third opinion, because you want to connect with that provider, that doctor who makes you feel heard and safe and taken care of. And then the next thing is take care of yourself. You deserve it.
Yeah. And you mentioned when we were chatting a little bit before we started recording that you are also developing an addictions practice for those who happen to be in the state of California. Would love for listeners to learn a little bit more about what that is, if they feel like they're a good candidate for something like that, or maybe they have patients they want to send your way, or if someone is maybe listening outside of the state of California, where they might be able to find the help and resources they need.
Thank you. That's an excellent question. Yes, I am in the process of launching an online telemedicine practice for addiction medicine care with primary care in, for the patients as well, because I'm a family medicine physician and I love approaching patients with a complete picture, because I've found that patients, when they see the dots connect, like the light bulb that goes off on their head, I love seeing that. My medicine practice is going to be called Zanara Care. And if you're interested in finding out about receiving care as under medical care, feel free to email me at Zanara, Z-E-N-A-R-A, care, C-A-R-E, at gmail.com. I do have a coaching practice as well for helping folks learn how to navigate through recovery, as well as a lot of times you might have family dynamics going into it. So the coaching aspect of it to help you figure out how to use your purpose, how to use your purpose to help drive you towards the success and the goal that you set to have a healthy, fulfilling, thriving life. That's what Transcendent You is for. And it's to encourage you to become a transcendent, which is a person who transcends their limits to become a fulfilled living life. And so for that, feel free to email me at Transcendent, TranscendentYOU at gmail.com.
And we'll be sure to include that in the show notes for anyone listening.
Wonderful. Thank you. So yeah, that's how you can reach me. And for the coaching, I'm available beyond the California boundaries.
Wonderful. Thank you.
I think the more I talk about it, I hope one day it will be at a place where recovery is encouraged and it's looked with empathy and people look at it as a journey. Maybe that's what I'd like to end on, is that recovery is a journey and it doesn't matter which heart you're on. What's important is that you don't give up. You don't give up on yourself. You don't give up on your dreams and you don't give up on your loved ones. And try to seek out the help that will help you get there, but it has to come from within. I like to tell my patients that you're the driver of your car, which is your body, and this journey, which is your life. I'm the GPS, so I just give directions. It is there if you want help. You have to drive your life yourself, so it is worth it.
And I love that sort of metaphor of the journey, because addiction often isn't a straight, narrow road from point A to point B. And the road to recovery also isn't a final destination. It really is a journey kind of experience. So that's a really lovely metaphor. So thank you so much, Dr. Nasir, for joining me on this episode of the podcast today. Really appreciated it.
Thank you, Dr. Glazer, for having me. It was a pleasure to be here and talk to you and your audience today.
Thank you.
Thanks for joining me for this week's episode. As you know, my goal is to share with you the most helpful information that moves you towards emotional well-being. If you have suggestions or questions, I'd love to hear those. And I also always appreciate a rating that will help others find this valuable content. I'm looking forward to connecting with you again next week. Please note that while I am a clinical doctor, this podcast is not a substitute for, nor should be taken as medical advice. No specific health advice is being given on this podcast, and no physician-client relationship is created by you listening to this podcast. All information provided on this podcast is for informational purposes.